I'm here to talk to you about security developer studies with GitHub developers and how we explored a convenience sample, which the sample was. And I've done this research with amazing collaborators from the University of Maryland and also Saarland University. So as you might all know, developers, whether or not they're experts at writing code in general, are mostly not security experts. And one would think, why are these people so stupid and lazy? Why can't people who write code not, like, why don't they just write secure code? If they administrate a website, why can't they just use a working and a correctly configured TLS certificate? If they do certificate validation, why don't they do it correctly? Whenever they encrypt, why can't they just do that in a secure way? Whenever they handle user data and passwords, why can't they just salt them, hash them, and treat them in a secure way? And with the research that we do, we try to get away from this this way of thinking and try to say, how can we make secure programming easier for developers to do? So not they have to learn things, but how can we help them do things in a secure way without them having to have this overhead of learning and trying very hard? So if we want to help them effectively, we need to continuously study developers to see what are the problems that they have, what are the ways that we can help them, what tools do they use that we could make better, and also when we make changes, do they actually help? But if we do these studies, there are several challenges that we have to consider. One of them is what type of study to use. So on the one hand, you want to get people into your lab so you can talk to them, observe them, hear what they say, and look at what they do. On the other hand, they might behave differently when they sit next to you, and it's also incredibly hard when you're not located exactly here to get developers to come to your lab. And also in those studies, when can you use conveniently available university students that you have running around as opposed to developers who you actually want to study? And then when you do these studies, how do you design useful study tasks? On the one hand, they need to be sufficiently complex to capture anything at all that is useful to you. On the other hand, you need them to be able to do these tasks in a short time frame and maybe also in your lab or in whatever environment you give them. The key question I want to talk about in this talk is the recruitment. So in an older study, this one that we did in 2016, we already recruited developers. At that time, we tried to get Android developers, and we found in this study that people were likely to produce insecure code when they use Stack Overflow, and I'll go over lessons learned from that in a moment. In a study this year, we studied the usability of different cryptographic APIs, and for that, we invited people to an online study in Python and reached a pretty different sample of people. So the one thing we learned from both studies was that you get horribly small opt-in rates. So in 2016, we sent 50,000 invites to Google Play developers to participate in a 10-minute survey, and we got roughly 300 valid responses. We also spent 3 months on recruiting people at three universities, none of them in the Bay Area, to try to get people into a lab study. We offered them $30 per participant. And in these 3 months, over three universities, we got 54 participants. And most of them were students, so not the developers we actually wanted to study. So in 2017, for the next study that we attempted, we decided to change our strategy. We emailed GitHub developers. In that case, we needed people with Python experience. And again, we got roughly the same opt-in rate and lots more dropouts that in that case we could measure. But still, it was pretty convenient, and also we got lots more professionals than in this study where we ran around and tried to recruit people at universities. Few of them had security background. So if we want to use GitHub in the future to study developers, we need to look at how does it work for security. What are the things that impact whether or not people on GitHub can be able to write secure code, and to who are the people who are willing to participate in our studies? Does it help in their code. If they're students, does it help? If they're professional developers, does it help that they have a lot of experience in the field that we're asking about? Does it help if they've had a security background? So to answer this, we attempted an online study with GitHub developers where we focused specifically on these questions. We, again, cloned repositories and extracted emails, and then in batches emailed a random sample of these people. Lots of these emails bounced, and some people requested to be blacklisted, but in the end, we got, again, 300 valid participants for our study. So if you look at this picture, you can see on the left for every of these categories, the people who we invited from GitHub. And the lighter blue colors to the right are actual participants or subsets of these participants. And you can see here several categories or measures of activity on GitHub. And you can also see that our participants were roughly the same as people on GitHub who we invited who decided not to participate. So while we can't say whether or not our sample was representative of GitHub in general or the developer population of people who wrote code in Python in general, we can say that they were at least activity-wise somewhat representative of GitHub people. We didn't get only the most active people or only the most inactive people. So we put them in order to observe the security impacting measures. We put them in an online programming study. We gave them three tasks in randomized order. These could be solved either securely or insecurely, and this could be done within roughly 20 minutes, so they didn't have to spend a huge amount of time on it. We tested these answers that they gave for functionality, and then we looked at their results manually and coded them for security or insecurity with two independent coders who then met and agreed and convinced each other that they were choosing the right option. In the end, we performed regressions on the functionality outcomes, on the security outcomes, and on the outcomes for dangerous code. In these regressions, as optional factors, we had the status of being a student or of being a professional or both or neither, and also the security expertise. And we also had, which I forgot to put on the slide, how many years of experience they had in coding in Python. The first task we gave them randomly was string encryption. We wanted them to encrypt and decrypt a string, which they could do securely by choosing secure algorithms, strong key sizes, and secure modes of operation only. The second thing they should do was storing user credentials, so a login name and a password in a SQLite database. And for security, we split this into two things that we looked at separately. For the database, we looked whether they performed any input sanitization, and for the storing of the passwords, we looked whether they hashed, and if they did, whether they used a strong hash function, and if they salted the password, and if they did, whether it was a random salt, and whether or not they reused the same salt over all potential users. And the last task was that we wanted them to write an URL shortener. So it should take as input a long URL and as output give a short one. And the secure solution in this case would be to use well-established mechanisms to do so, or random number generators, and to not come up with their own mechanism of transferring a long to short URL. And they should do this in some way, or at least superficially irreversibly, so that we wouldn't just have a very clear mapping of the short to the long URL back. We did this, or they did this, in an online coding editor. So we gave them the task description, and then we gave them a code skeleton with the method that they had to edit, marked. And then they could write code, run and test it, and when they felt that they were finished successfully or unsuccessfully, they could tell us so, and then they would be taken to the next task, or in the end, to an exit survey. If we look at the results, they're split here by the three tasks that we had. And we decided that the most interesting difference in these people that we wanted to look at was whether they were professionals or students. And as you can see, that they performed roughly the same across all tasks, and also that these groups of people performed roughly the same across all tasks. So what differentiated their results and functionality was experience. Per year of Python experience, they were 10% better at finding a functional solution for the task. And also some tasks were just easier to solve than others. The things that were not relevant for functionality in our regression were being a student or being a professional or, sadly, having a security background. But this might be better for security. I know, but you don't know yet. So for the security results, we did the same thing. We have here the four tasks because we split one of them. And as you see here, the tasks differ, but the people don't really. So in this case, it was harder to get string encryption and password storage correct, and the other two tasks were somewhat easier for people. And again, if we look at the differentiators, experience mattered again. So for each year of Python experience that people had, they had a 5% better chance at getting a secure solution. And again, easier tasks were easier to solve, so some tasks worked better. Sadly, the factors that were not significant for security included being a student, being a professional, and, again, having a security background. The last thing I want to talk to you about is the dangerous code that people wrote. So in the end, we asked them, after they'd written the code, whether or not they thought it was secure. And the green thing you can see here is that a third of the code they wrote was secure, and they also thought it was secure, which is a good thing. The bad thing is that it's only 35%. On the right, you can see that half of the code they wrote, they thought was insecure, which was only true in half of those cases. And the red thing you can see is the dangerous code that was insecure according to our decisions that we made, and they thought it was secure. The good thing is, this is like the smallest group of code, but then again, 12% is not nothing. So again, we did a regression and checked what impacted this, and we didn't find any differentiator. So people with more experience were no better at guessing correctly or at making the right decision here. And these are the in-production code that we are concerned about. So what can we take away from the study that we did, or what can you take away? If you do developer studies on GitHub, you will get a very strong opt-in bias. Only very few people will be willing to donate their time to your study. But at least in activity metrics, you will still get a representative sample of GitHub, so you will not get edge cases of people on average. And in the study, we were able to get interesting results in a pretty short time and without having to talk to actual people and bully them into coming to our lab. For our sample here, being a student versus being a professional developer did not matter for our outcomes. Experience did matter. So if you do a study with people who you recruit in a different way, take into account their experience and correct for that. And security background, sadly, did not matter in our outcomes. For future work, we can imagine to take a pretty similar study and compare different populations so that in the next study after that, you will know whether or not you represent the populations that you want to actually look at. So we can imagine looking at students recruited at universities, and we can imagine looking at professionals recruited maybe from companies. One last thing as a future strategy for recruiting GitHub users, it's maybe a better idea to use an application that allows GitHub users to opt into academic studies ahead of time instead of using your university email account to email all of these people that you want to talk to. That was it for me, and I'll take questions.
Quick question with these users that you got this time compared to the ones that you did with the API study. Were they the same users? Was there a bunch of overlap? And if you are seeing overlap, is there any fear that if we all start jumping on the GitHub bandwagon, we're going to cause fatigue in these users and get them to reject any willingness to participate?
That's a problem for studies done by other people. Luckily not in this case, because we use the same strategy, so we just randomly emailed new people. Especially once we ask them to opt in, we will probably get the same problem that we have with MTurk, for example, that like all the people study the same populations again and again. So I don't have a solution for that. I wish I did, but I don't. On the other hand, maybe it's still better to do this. Maybe these are not the same people across programming languages, because the strategy we have right now is to use students, and at our university, students don't kind of renew themselves in a way that we don't get overlap there. So maybe the overlap that we get with traditional studies is equally as bad or even worse.
Probably great work regardless. Thanks.
So can you maybe elaborate a little bit more on the security experts being really bad at this? Do you think maybe they're lying about their expertise or some other property, or are we lying to ourselves about how good we are, perhaps?
So security expertise in this case was whether they had worked in security, few people had done that, and whether they had taken security classes. And those were the people, like the large chunk of people who had security experience were those who had taken security classes. So when I say experience in security didn't help, then I'm not saying like that a 10-year work experience in security didn't help, but I'm saying that having sat through a class didn't help. I initially I didn't want to say that, but he made me.
Hi, I really sympathize with the difficulty of getting people to participate in a study like this. But I have to ask, if you have such a small number of small percentage of people that volunteer, there's quite likely to be some sort of selection bias. Have you thought about doing an observational study where instead of getting people to volunteer, you look through public GitHub repositories that have had bugs reported and try to figure out where the bugs came from and who contributed them?
So this is a thing that we also do for other projects. What you can't do with that is do a controlled experiment.
Right.
You can't say, like, you have to use this library and you're not making the choice, because one of the things that come with this library kind of appeals to you, but I'm making this choice as a researcher, and then I look at the outcome. So this is just not possible with that strategy, but we use it. We definitely use it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm very curious about the large percentage of people who wrote code that they thought would be insecure. And I'd like to think that if that was your job, you would just take more time to write secure code. So I wonder if maybe the compensation could have been insufficient for the difficulty of the task, and maybe people would have taken some extra effort to write secure code if they were incentivized more.
So we talked about this yesterday in a workshop where Heather and her colleagues did a study where they tried to give students in classes extra credit for secure code, and they also kind of try to get them in that way. And just extra credit also didn't help. So the question is, we also want to represent the real world in our studies somewhat. I mean, if I say, like, you get $500 if you write really, really secure code in this thing and you have 5 hours of time, then I might get really, really good results in my study. But in this case, for example, we didn't pay people, and they also usually publish code on GitHub, for which they are probably also not paid. So if we in our studies give like really, really big incentive to write secure code, then how do we map this onto the real world? But good question.
Hi, Andrew McNamara from NC State. I had a question. I saw in the paper you went through a brief overview of general categories of the security vulnerabilities that you saw, including plain password or password stored in the clear and not using salts. I was wondering if there's any security issues that you found that were maybe unexpected. I know that those aren't the low-hanging fruits, but are there any more insights that we can gain from the types of vulnerabilities that might be introduced.
So when they didn't get like easy things incorrect, what often happened that they had like a strategy of doing a thing in an insecure way that didn't work in a functional way. So they would start writing something from scratch where we couldn't really tell whether or not it would have been secure or not, but they didn't finish it anyway or didn't get it to run anyway. But yeah, like if you're really super interested in detail what people got insecure, then you can find that in the paper.